It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is projected to miss out on at least $2 billion in sales tax revenue on the construction of four data center projects in the state. The state's previous two-year budget carved out a sales tax exemption for these projects as a way to attract them here.
This latest estimate from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau says the construction of data centers in Beaver Dam, Port Washington, Mount Pleasant, and Verona would have generated $1.5 billion in sales tax, plus another $369 million per year once they're operating.
Supporters say the tax breaks help bring in projects that might not have come here without that financial incentive, and that those data centers will bring economic benefits to the state.
In just a bit, we'll hear from the head of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce on the potential economic impact of those incentives for data center construction. First, a look at state policy surrounding them.
For that, we have Jody Habish-Sinikin, a Democratic state senator from Whitefish Bay. Her district includes Port Washington and areas north of Milwaukee. She and Senate Democratic leader Dianne Hesselbein requested this Legislative Fiscal Bureau estimate. Senator Habish-Sinikin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you very much.
Did anything surprise you in this Fiscal Bureau projection?
I was looking to have this estimate because I have been very much trying to understand where we are at and what the pros and cons of the current trajectory that Wisconsin is on. I think it's important for listeners to understand where we are at in Wisconsin compared to other states. And with this sales and use tax exemption, it is coming in terms of a regulatory vacuum. So people need to understand that in the Republican-controlled legislature, we've had a number of data center bills that call for regulation, including my data center accountability bill, which I introduced in November. And what we have instead is a complete and persistent regulatory void or vacuum in the state. So other than the sales and use tax exemption, we have no laws and no regulations on the books. And what it's leading to is growing concern and rejection by communities across Wisconsin to data center development, which I personally think is unfortunate because we as a state need to be progressing economically and keeping pace with other states in our region and around the country. Well, so I just want to point that out where we're starting from.
Dozens of states do, though, have these different financial incentives to lure data centers. Do you think these large data center projects still would have come to Wisconsin without these sales tax exemptions?
I don't think so. I think that in looking at the 37 other states that have comparable exemptions as well as tax incentives separate from that, it is an important draw. And as a senator who is this rare combination of a longtime environmental lawyer and also a Wisconsin business owner and manufacturer, I can appreciate how important it is to keep Wisconsin competitive with other states and allow for maximal economic opportunities. Where the sticking point is that we are doing so in the midst of in a regulatory void.
So would
and
you?
And it's that vacuum which is causing the problem.
So in the midst of this regulatory void, would you support rolling back some of these sales tax exemptions as other states have, or perhaps introducing some clawbacks?
What I think is important is exactly taking a beat to read the room, to understand where the polling is showing us, like the recent Marquette Law poll, which shows that 70% of Wisconsin citizens feel that the drawbacks of data centers outweigh the positives. We need to read the room there and understand that folks are seeking reassurance and certainty when it comes to affordability concerns, environmental concerns, workforce issues, and the like. So yes, I think it's important as a state that we take a beat and understand, which we are able to do far better now than when the sales and use tax was initially introduced. We have a lot more information now regarding community response, as well as how they have been successful in drawing entities here. But we can only progress if communities continue to accept them in their midst. And that's why I'm looking for appropriate calibration as we can have this discussion going forward.
Up very quickly here, Public Service Commission approves the special rate plan for We Energies last week for these large-scale data center customers. Are you on board with how that's structured?
I think it is well done, and it's actually exactly what we called for in my data center accountability bill for all utilities in the state. This was a strong move by the PSC to try to provide some assurance to ratepayers in that area that they will not have to bear the costs of these hyperscale data centers.
State Senator Habersh-Sinikin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jody Habersh-Sinikin there, Democratic State Senator from Whitefish Bay. Now we shift focus to some of the potential economic benefits of data center construction. Dale Coinga is President and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, former Republican state lawmaker. Dale, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate the longer form here to get more of the details.
Wisconsin is one of 38 states that offer tax incentives for these large data centers. That's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. How important are incentives like sales tax exemptions for attracting these large projects here?
Well, I will tell you, as someone who was intimately familiar with the negotiations on these projects, is it's very, very simple, is that if we did not have this incentive like 38 other states, we simply would not have the work. It's really interesting. Moody's did an analysis of what states' economies are shrinking, what states' economies are treading water, and what states' economies are growing. And the Wisconsin economy is growing. It really stands out in the Midwest as one of the only economies growing in the Midwest. But if you look at those numbers and take out the data center investment, our economy would not be growing. I would argue in the history of America, there's never been a time where trade unions and business groups are so aligned that these men and women out there building these data centers, they're not building just buildings. They're building the world's largest, fastest computers that are going to make our healthcare system better, advanced manufacturing better, our national defense better. And so we should be proud of this work. We should be very glad that we have this work, because what the article doesn't mention here is that we're going to get exponentially more in property tax revenue, income tax revenue, secondary sales tax revenue. So net-net, this is a great investment for Wisconsin, and it's especially a win for Wisconsin's working class.
But a developer's initial investment, as you mentioned, it can be robust with the hiring of the local construction workers. But after that data center is up and running, it can be just a dozen or so employees with full-time jobs there. Is that a trade-off with little long-term job creation or economic growth?
Well, it's not dozens of employees. It's thousands of employees. It's thousands of employees, not dozens. And
the
other thing that happens—
Per data center.
Per data center. I mean, one data center is going to be 1,500 employees. So we still have thousands of employees, and it's thousands more construction jobs. And these aren't short-term construction jobs. These are construction jobs that are going to take place over years and years. The other thing is that when the TIFs paid off and this money, this property tax revenue, which is absolutely jaw-dropping, where does it go? It goes to the local school. It goes to the local tech college. It goes to the municipality. You know, we believe here at MMAC that our teachers are underpaid. And so if we're looking at how can we pay our teachers more to invest in education, we need more property tax revenue. So when you're looking at the longer term game on this, and granted it is a couple of years out because you have to pay the debt back first on these projects, is this is an amazing opportunity for those communities to fund their schools like no schools in this nation have been funded before.
But the statewide polling, it's found a significant majority of Wisconsinites think that the costs of new data center projects outweigh the possible benefits. How should state and local leaders then respond to these voters' negative perceptions of these projects going up in their communities?
Well, part of the problem that I pointed out yesterday, which I think led to this interview, is your headline and the headline of the Journal Sentinel says data centers cost the state $2 billion. Now, you know in your industry, and a Penn State study says somewhere between 70% and 80% only read the headline. Now, if you actually read that article in the details, you have University of Wisconsin professors, you have many other experts to say, yeah, Wisconsin would not get this if we didn't have this incentive in the first place. And those same articles say nothing about property tax revenue. They say nothing about income tax revenue. They say nothing about the fact that you want to be close, a trauma one center for emergencies. You want to be close to these data centers, all the different benefits of it. So the headline is enough where you know only 75% of people – 75% of people read the headline, they don't read the article, and this is not a cost. I will tell you as a CPA, a cost is something you pay for. I think a better example would be like, what if Boeing said, hey, Wisconsin, we want to produce 747s in the state of Wisconsin, but the only thing we ask for is we don't think we should have to pay sales tax on the components that go in the 747. Whether it be Governor Evers or Governor Walker or whoever the next governor is, every single governor would jump at that opportunity to say, there's a lot of benefits here that we don't have to worry about the sales tax. We want to build 747s here in Wisconsin. And right now what we could do is AI is going to be manufactured in Wisconsin. We want this work, and this is a very, very small price tag to pay to make sure that this work is done in Wisconsin. And I want AI made in Wisconsin, not China.
But if these companies are already willing to spend billions of dollars on this construction, would a 5% sales tax make that much of a difference for them and their bottom line?
It does, because when you're talking about 5% across billions, that really, really adds up. And so there's other states that say, hey, if you're not going to build it there, then we'll take it here.
Very quickly, your organization joined in filing a lawsuit against the city of Port Washington over the legality of an ordinance. Can you talk about in just briefly what is your concern with that referendum?
Yeah, absolutely. State law is very specific on the process in order to do a TIF. And in that state law, it doesn't allow local voters to be part of that process. We really respect that local voters have to have a say. And that's the relationship between them and their city council. But these are very complicated issues. But also, more importantly, is these come up fast. And a company is not going to wait around for the next election to do development. And they're also not going to put their name on a ballot. Just like 99% of Wisconsinites say, I'm not putting my name on a ballot. It's close to 99% of companies that would also say, if we're doing this project, there's no need for us to put our name on a ballot.
Dale, we have to leave it there. Dale Coinga, President and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce.
Coming up, Wisconsin's prison population includes a lot more people over age 65. An expert on prison health care says that creates a lot of challenges for aging inmates.
Being able to walk far distances, being able to stand in line for things like food and medicine, being able to get in and out of bunk beds if you need to, being able to maneuver around small spaces and cells.
That's next here on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. A recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows the incarceration rate among adults 60 years and older nearly doubled in Wisconsin between 2010 and 2023.
And the age of people incarcerated in the state is increasing. That raises challenges for the State Department of Corrections, how to care for that aging population in prison, and how to deal with the increased costs of that care.
Joe Pietrangelo is the research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. The recently published report is titled Cross-Examination, A Comprehensive Review of Wisconsin's Criminal Justice System. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we focus in on the specifics of the aging prison population, I want to get an overview as you dug into Wisconsin's incarcerated population. What were some of the big things that stood out to you in your findings?
Well, so this report really examined Wisconsin's criminal justice system from arrests to courts to the state prisons. And even how the system is staffed and financed. But in terms of the incarcerated population specifically, we've seen some significant trends in recent years. One is just an increase in the aging population throughout the justice system. We also see a number of racial disparities in the system, specifically higher rates of involvement in the system for the Black and American Indian populations relative to their shares of the state's population. We are spending more in Wisconsin on the correction system than most other states. We rank 12th on state and local spending on the correction, specifically on corrections, so the state prisons. And we've also seen some changes in the specific types of offenses that are driving the increase in incarceration, an increase in drunk driving and certain types of violent crime as well.
And then let's turn to this aging population in prison. We have an aging population in Wisconsin as a whole. What, paint us a picture of how our prison population is aging. Give us some of the numbers there.
Yeah, so the first thing that we noticed was that there's been a doubling of the rate, the incarceration rate of people ages 60 and over in the state's prisons since 2010. So that's a pretty short period of time to see a doubling of that population. So to give some context, from 2000, in 2000, there were 330 people in Wisconsin's prisons who were age 60 and over. In 2023, it was 1,960. So that's just a huge increase in a 20-year period. We also have seen a big increase in those in their 50s in state prisons, from under 1,000 in the year 2000 to over 3,200 in 2023. So we've seen some really big increases. And so first we thought, okay, so the state's population is aging, and we know that that is a factor. There's also differences, or there have been changes in state law that are resulting in people spending longer periods of time in prison so that they're aging in place. One big factor there is truth in sentencing, which went into effect in 2000. And that essentially made it more difficult, essentially eliminated parole in Wisconsin and resulted in people spending longer periods in prison. But what we found when we looked closer is that there has also been a big increase in admissions of these older adults into state prisons. And so it's not only aging people and people staying in prison longer, but it's also more older adults entering prison at an older age.
And I wanted to dig into both of those points. And that second part, I'll be honest, surprised me. I assumed it was going to be mostly truth in sentencing. What are we seeing older people entering the correction system? What kind of crimes are bringing them into prisons?
Well, we've seen some increases specifically in certain offenses that are also increasing in the broader adult population. Operating while intoxicated is one of those things. Also, certain types of violent crime, such as assault, has increased among the older adult population. We don't know exactly what's behind that. And disorderly conduct was another one. So those were just a few examples of some of the specific offenses that have increased over time.
Now, you mentioned Wisconsin is on the high end when it comes to prison spending. We've got an aging prison population. How much more does it cost to have an inmate over 65 as opposed to, say, someone in their 20s? Is this part of what's driving our costs here?
That's sort of a theory that we have. We haven't been able to pin down all of the details on that, but we do know that healthcare has been one of the big increasing costs for the correction system. Older adults are more likely to need medical care. The DOC, the Department of Corrections, their spending on healthcare for adults has nearly tripled since 2005, and that's been the biggest increase in its budget. So we do think that's part of it. The Department of Corrections has built an assisted living unit at one prison for those with advanced medical needs. So again, there are signs that point to this is one of the factors driving Wisconsin's higher than average spending on corrections.
Joe, a lot more, as you mentioned in this report. We'll have a link up at WPR.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is the research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Its latest report is called Cross-Examination, a Comprehensive Review of Wisconsin's Criminal Justice System. Now we turn to Dr. Farah Kakso, an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and hospital medicine clinician at UW Health. She studies aging and care in prison systems. Dr. Kakso, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your reaction to this data in this report, especially when it comes to the number of people over 55 and over 65 in our prison system in the state?
Yeah, unfortunately, I am not surprised by the results that Joe told us about. The trends that we are seeing here in Wisconsin, we are seeing nationwide. All states in the country are dealing with these challenges. I did find the issue of disorderly conduct, that was one of the increasing reasons for incarceration, very interesting. We know that as people age, they have increased risks of dementia and cognitive impairment. And so I wonder if some of this disorderly conduct is actually more likely due to developing dementia. And then finally, one comment on the costs issue, and Joe makes an excellent point. We don't have a ton of data on the costs for caring for people in prisons, particularly in state prisons, because each state prison operates independently and is, you know, left to its own devices, doesn't have a lot of support for collecting and maintaining that data. The federal prison system is a little bit, you know, has a little bit more support for doing that sort of work, but they are a very small portion of the people who are incarcerated in the country.
Now, with people at higher ages being in prison, you know, somebody living alone, somebody living in a senior living facility, well, they might need extra accommodations. I'm guessing that is true in a prison as well. What kind of things, what kind of needs do you see as you work with this population?
Yeah, great question. So when we think about people in the community, we talk about activities of daily living. And do people need help with things such as bathing, eating, other, you know, things we have to do every day? In prison, in the research community, there's discussion about what we call prison activities of daily living. And these include things like being able to walk far distances, being able to stand in line for things like food and medicine, being able to get in and out of bunk beds if you need to, being able to maneuver around, you know, in small spaces, in cells, and then also being able to communicate your healthcare needs, oftentimes to non-health professionals, so correctional officers. Even though it's not in their job description, are often the first line of triage for when patients need something. And if, as you can imagine, as an older person, potentially with developing cognitive impairment or just general sickness, being able to communicate those needs can be very challenging.
If somebody with the Department of Corrections in this state or any other asked you, hey, what kind of things should we do? How should we be accommodating these needs? What would be at the top of your list for them?
I probably recognition of the issues is the first step, right? We can't fix the problem if we can't see the problem. And one of the interesting things about people who are incarcerated, one of the unique issues that they face is what we call accelerated aging. And this is something that has been known about for a long time. It's been studied in people who have had what we call adverse childhood experiences. So really just any stressor, anybody who has a significant stressor in their life can experience advanced biological aging, where the cells actually age faster than if they hadn't experienced that stress. And so for, you know, a 50-year-old person who's been incarcerated for a long time, they may actually, you know, be much older than their 50 years. And there is data to support that somebody who's 50 and has been incarcerated for many years has the same geriatric risks as somebody 15, even 20 years older. So being able to recognize that, I think, is the most important first step.
Now, there's a thing called compassionate release for medical conditions. Often, as I understand it, rarely used in Wisconsin. As our prison population ages, could you see things like compassionate release playing a bigger role in our prison system?
Yes, absolutely. I will say compassionate release is rarely used throughout the country. It's pretty uncommon, not just in Wisconsin. And there is actually some interesting data during COVID under the CARES Act. There was an increase in the number of people who were released under compassionate release. And the data there did show that those people who were released under the CARES Act had much lower rates of reoffending than others. There's also data from the Families Against Mandatory Minimums that suggests that people kind of age out of committing crimes. And people who are released under compassionate release laws are much, much less likely in the federal system, which is the data we have, to be reincarcerated. So I think as this population ages, it's going to be super important for all the states to be able to identify those people at lowest risk of reoffending to, you know, for potential compassionate release. And this is an area of increased research, again, throughout the country at many different institutions.
Dr. Cakeso, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Farah Cakeso is an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and hospital medicine clinician at UW Health. She studies aging and care in prison systems. Earlier, we heard from Joe Pietrangelo, research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We talked about their recent report, Cross-Examination, a Comprehensive Review of Wisconsin's Criminal Justice System.
Coming up, a debut novelist from Wisconsin is inspired by Indigenous American mythology and wants to make Native folklore come alive in his new book for middle grade readers.
How do I celebrate these cultures, this piece of myself, in a way that also any kid can pick up? I came around to this idea of living myths.
The author of Miss Speaker, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin author's debut middle grade novel is a thrilling fantasy adventure inspired by Indigenous American folktales.
A 13-year-old boy is destined to save the world. Kaita and his friends have to return the precious egg of the world turtle that's been stolen by invaders. And all living things are at risk of perishing because everything exists on the vast shell of the world turtle continent.
Wisconsin author Christopher Rubik draws from his Cajun and rural Wisconsin upbringing in his novel called Myth Speaker. It explores themes of teamwork, self-worth, and respect for nature. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You didn't fit in as a kid growing up in rural Elkhart Lake. What was hard?
Well, it's one of those funny things about growing up in a small town is that everyone knows everyone. The town never changes. And that's wonderful in some ways, but especially as a kid who doesn't fit in, unfortunately, once you don't fit in, you never do. And so for me, that kind of meant that starting from a pretty young age, you're a known quantity. I always tried my best. I cared a lot about school and doing well. And those are great things, but it also became something where teachers and other parents would say, oh, you know, he's special. He's, you know, he's doing well in school. He's involved in these programs or things like that. And that word special became something that followed me all through school until I graduated. And special is wonderful right up until it isn't.
How do you process those things differently, or how does it inform your writing your novel, Myth Speaker?
So Myth Speaker fundamentally, like, you know, especially kids' books, is a story of a chosen one, of a destined hero. Someone who has been told from, well, in Kaita's case, since he was 5 years old, that he was going to save the world, that he was going to have to. And that happens all the time. We have so many stories like that. But for me, the part of that that I never really saw in things, but that I felt from when I was a little kid, was how hard that has to be. I have this vivid memory, and I've written a little bit about this elsewhere, of being in the fifth grade. And we were doing a parent-teacher conference, and the teacher was saying, oh, you know, he's done really well, his grades are great, et cetera. And then he looked at my mom and very completely seriously said, I think he's going to be the president one day, and I think he'll be great. And he wasn't joking, he meant it. And I remember sitting there, I mean, fifth grade, so what was I, nine, maybe 10?
About 10, yeah.
Yeah, about 10, so, you know, middle grade age. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know how to be a president. I don't know if I can do that. How am I going to learn how to do that? And it fed this same sort of thing that always kind of followed me, this idea that it's wonderful to be special. It's wonderful for Keita to be a destined hero, except how do you live up to that? How do you make that work as you get older?
Keita, this 13-year-old who learns through a prophecy, as you say, that he will save the world. Mm-hmm. Keita is also born with this extraordinary gift of understanding any language, any language. Why did you give Keita this gift?
So there's two pieces to that. And one of them is very under the hood writing, kind of. When you're introducing, you know, a fantasy world, and for Mythspeaker, I wrote a language for the book. So all of the character names, the little bits of words we get in other languages, that is a language. Those words mean things. And I loved the idea of that. But I realized, you know, the fundamental other side of the story is that there are people coming from not just another place on Keita's continent, which is on the back of a enormous flying turtle, but they're coming from a different continent altogether. They will not understand a word of the languages spoken where Keita is from, and no one on Keita's side will understand their languages either. So the first part of it just emerged from, I need some way for Keita to be able to understand what's being said and what's going on. And since this world is one built around not just myth, but living myth, you know, these are characters living amidst the figures of their stories going back thousands of years. Why not then tie that sort of living history of the world into Keita and solve two problems, both make him something special, but not in the way of, you know, he's not super strong or super fast. He isn't super smart. He might be super sarcastic sometimes. He probably has that going. But I love the idea of, if he has any quote unquote superpower, it's just that he can understand anyone.
You talk about living myth, and we meet Old Moon Eyes, and he's not just a frog. He is a living myth, and he talks. So can you describe what are living myths in indigenous folklore, and why are they so wise?
Living myths is a term I came up with for this book to try and capture one of the recurring themes of indigenous American mythology, a thing you see, you know, across the stories of the whole continent. And it's worth noting that, you know, there are many hundreds of unique cultures that have lived in just North America over the last, you know, hundreds and thousands of years, and that they all have unique stories and histories and cultures. But many of them, you often see animals, and not just any animals, but special animals, and at times spirits, or I don't want to say inhuman, but other human beings that interact with people, sometimes equally, sometimes very much not equally. And they're used to explain things in the world that, you know, these native groups, these amazing cultures were seeing around them at the time these stories first came to be. And when I was thinking about how do I celebrate these cultures, this piece of myself in a way that also any kid can pick up and understand, I came around to this idea of living myths. Because when we talk about myths, we talk about them like they're dead things. Mm-hmm. And so why not immediately outright say they're not just dead things, they're living things, and then show you one. You know, with Old Moon Eyes, we meet right away, and he is literally older than dirt. He is a forest in a, well, not a person, but a personage. And he's Keita's best friend.
Yeah. You know, Keita recites these words under his breath. Hope is a feeling, but faith is a choice, a fire we keep burning, even if we must rub together the embers ourselves.
Yeah.
How do you identify with Keita's words about faith?
Oh, that is a great question. And this is something that has sort of been a way of looking at the world that I've grown into as I've gotten older. I have always been an optimist. I've been called a hopeless optimist because I just, I believe in the wonder of things. Mm. The author John Green has said in recent years, hope is correct. And I really do believe that. But the tough thing about hope is that a lot of the time hope is a feeling, and feelings are mutable. Feelings change from moment to moment based on what we're thinking. Faith goes deeper than that. Faith is trusting in something or someone. It can be yourself. It can be the people around you. It can be institutions or your religious beliefs. And for me, especially when I started writing this book, we had just come out of the pandemic, and I saw so many people struggling with, like, okay, what are we hopeful for? What are we moving forward toward? Yeah. And for me, this book and that theme, because faith is a recurring theme of the book, it was all about remembering that even when you don't feel hope necessarily, A, it doesn't mean that it's not there. Feelings are, like, they change all the time. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're not, you know, with you just because you don't feel it. But also, faith is something you can choose no matter what. And even if it means you have to remind yourself of it, you have to rub those embers together, you have to put in the work, that faith, that trust can always be there. And that faith and trust most of the time leads you right back to the hope you were looking for.
Christopher, thank you so much for sharing MythSpeaker with us, and thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That is Wisconsin author Christopher Rubik. His debut middle grade novel called MythSpeaker is inspired by Indigenous American mythology and his rural Wisconsin upbringing. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.